Grab your trowel and a cup of coffee, as you're listening to Archaeo Cafe. I'm your host, Otis Crandell. Welcome to another episode of Archaeo Cafe. I'm Otis, and today I'm talking with Sarah Smith, consulting archaeologist at Stantec in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Otis. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here today. So I'm curious, what first got you interested in archaeology?
Oh, well, I mean, I grew up on the west coast of Vancouver Island in a really remote area. And when I was a kid, I was really interested in geology. And then I think like a lot of children born in the early 80s, I started seeing the Indiana Jones movies. I know it's sort of a common answer. And I'm like, is that a job? And then when I was 13, I was in grade 8 and I did a job shadow. And I, as a sort of a joke, I put archaeologist as my future job prospect. Mm-hmm. And well done on my middle school. They actually found a consulting archaeologist in Duncan where I went to junior high. Ooh. And I went and spent time with, his name's Bjorn Simonsen. He's actually a very well-known consultant. He's retired many years ago now. And I spent the day with him. And that was kind of it for me. I was like, oh, I can work as an archaeologist and explore history where I live. So, and after that, I was just hooked.
So after that, did you take more courses in history or how did that progress?
You know, I stayed with geology and history, but again, I was only 13 when that happened. And then I just went straight into an undergraduate degree in anthropology at the University of British Columbia.
Yeah, okay.
And then started working as a consultant right after my undergrad and have been working in the field for about 16 years. So.
Wow. Yeah, I think probably movies and television got a lot of people at least interested in archaeology. Probably got a lot of people interested in it that didn't actually make a career of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good on you for actually following through with, with one of your really early objectives.
It's a really common job when you meet people, they're like, oh, I always wanted to do that, but I didn't know it was actually an option. So that's always funny.
What is the most interesting site that you've visited?
Well, I did my field studies in China and we visited a site when we were there. We visited many sites, but we visited one site that was a tomb, a shaft tomb that had a war chariot and a horse that had been driving it and the drivers, all skeletal remains in place, buried in this tomb with this chariot. And they were removing the whole thing in one piece to take to the museum. Mm-hmm. So getting to see that was really amazing. But in British Columbia, the most interesting site I worked on, I mean, they're all so interesting, but I worked on a site for over a year with the Catesy First Nation in Pitt Meadows here in BC, and it had a wet site component. So there was preserved basketry and there's evidence of potato, like a Wapato potato. It's like a wetland potato, evidence of farming practices. And just the wooden preserved artifacts that were thousands of years old, really, I just found really interesting. It was such a time capsule.
Is it a very anaerobic type, like a swampy sort of setting?
Yeah, it's like a wetland environment, and it's creates this peat layer of soil that is anaerobic. And so as soon as you excavate the materials, they immediately have to be put in water, and then you have to preserve them with that PEG 400 wax, but because they immediately degrade. It's like ocean archaeology, you know, mm-hmm. taking things up from the deep.
But that's really good, though, to have the opportunity to collect organic material. I mean, it's so mm-hmm. rarely that we get to see that.
Yeah, and that specific site, because I worked so closely with the band, we found one braided piece of material, and it was hard to tell what it was. And we were talking to a gentleman in the community, an older gentleman, and he said, "Oh, it's a headband for holding your berry basket on your back." Well, my grandmother had one. It's called a tump line, and I just thought that connection was amazing. Wow. It really stood out in my mind.
What is your main subject of interest in archaeology?
I mean, I would say my personal main interest in archaeology has always been like how ancient people interacted with the environment and how those populations interacted with one another. So really landscape archaeology. And then what role those resources being available and those environmental changes had over time with those interactions. But I would say the best part of my job is getting to help Indigenous communities make those connections with the past and helping to understand how their ancestors lived and seeing their oral histories really come to life.
One thing that you've worked with and spoken about is the use of LIDAR in archaeology. What is LIDAR?
So I just completed my master's degree, and my topic of research was the use of LIDAR in archaeology. So LIDAR stands for light detection and ranging, and it's acquired when a fixed wing aircraft, or you can use a drone nowadays or satellite, but it surveys an area and it emits a near infrared pulse laser towards the ground surface. And then there's a specialized receiver in the plane, and it measures the time and intensity of the returning light of those lasers. So for example, if it hits tree canopy, some of the laser will go through to the ground, and the amount and resonance of that laser that comes back is measured. And then the point cloud is georeferenced, so you can create a point cloud of data that represents the elevation of the entire ground surface, and you can make a bare earth representation of the ground. So you can remove all buildings and vegetation and just see what the earth's surface looks like, and can be very useful for archaeological survey.
What are some of the ways that LIDAR has been used in the past for archaeological research?
Well, it's been used for about the last 20 years. It's not developed for archaeology. It's developed for other kinds of survey and geology. It's been used a lot in Europe because there's a lot of open source LIDAR data there for planning purposes. And it's often used in places to find archaeological sites that have a surface expression, such as like castles or old walls or roads, or those lots of Roman infrastructure can be easily identified using LIDAR. In places where there's really dense forest vegetation, like Mesoamerica, there's a really famous site down in Belize, Caracol, where they did a LIDAR survey, and they thought it was a small city in Mesoamerica, mm-hmm. and they realized that it was actually like a huge hub, and nobody had any idea because the LIDAR data showed an intense network of buildings that moved out from it. So it can be really useful in areas that are really densely forested and really hard to access.
Yeah, I read about that research. I think that it was huge when it first came out, and it really put LIDAR on the map, and everyone was talking about it.
Right.
But since then, it's become very popular, and you hear a lot about LIDAR being used now.
Yeah, it's getting much more common now. And I mean, they used it at Angkor Wat in Cambodia, for example. I think it was like 2014. Mm-hmm. And they mapped all the progression of the construction of all those buildings.
Oh, right.
And, you know, they are using it to show the expansion and fall of that civilization and how environmental impacts from like water shortages and things like that probably contributed to it. It's a really detailed study. But, I mean, in modern times, it's used a lot for monitoring erosion, and you can use it to map like sea level changes and things like that. So it's great for finding paleo-environmental landscapes, like where did the sea level used to be,
right.
And can we use that information to find archaeological sites?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's progressing quite fast, too.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about the Highland Valley Copper Mine area where you did your research?
Yeah, so the Highland Valley Copper Mine is located in the interior of British Columbia. It's in a really high alpine setting. It's like a high valley, and the area's been mined for copper by Teck Resources Limited since, I want to say, the 60s. And in this specific valley, the ore is actually in the bottom of the valley instead of in the ridges. So the original valley had three lakes that drained into two different watersheds, and, you know, would have been used by the First Nations in the area for high alpine hunting purposes, right? So you're expecting to see like lithic artifact sites and things like that. And then they drained the lakes and created like a tailings pond for mining. And so the First Nations that are managing the archaeology program there, the Iñtlilqabaq Nation Tribal Council, they had some desire to do some research about how can they use all the data they're collecting in a way to improve, how can they use LIDAR technology that's already existing for the mine to improve their ability to find archaeological sites in this area. So there was actually a grant available through the MITAX program and Teck was to support this project. And I was trying to answer a few specific research goals that the community had. And those involved how to contribute to improving their heritage stewardship in the area. And then, like I said, analyzing collected but incompletely studied heritage program data, and then applying this new technology and technique to address these critical issues and enhance the effectiveness of site identification.
Interesting. And what were the overall objectives of your study?
So the overall objective was to determine how LIDAR data and analysis methods could be incorporated into the archaeological toolkit to facilitate Indigenous heritage stewardship goals and compliance-based heritage management, and to add value for the development proponent as well.
What methods did you use to test the usage of LIDAR?
So the LIDAR data was already collected by the mine, which is great, because the hardest thing about, and probably the most expensive thing about doing a LIDAR survey, is collecting that data. So they already had it for their planning purposes and geological planning. So I first took that LIDAR data that was existing, and I visualized it using several methods. So for this study, each visualization technique, apart from standard hillshade, which is, if you ever see LIDAR data visualized, it's almost always shown to the public in standard hillshade. And that's just in the digital format, in the digital world in ArcGIS software, for example. It's assuming an illumination of those data points, and then it creates a shadow to show you what the landscape would look like. And I used a Relief Visualization Toolkit open source software, which I can't highly recommend enough. It was created by Zaksic and colleagues in 2011. And this ARVIT tool allows you to upload this raster data from LIDAR-derived digital elevation models to be output as a bunch of different types of visualizations. And I wanted to do that so that I could take that data and maybe enhance different parts of the landscape, because I was looking for these little microtopographic areas and terraces where First Nations people would have spent time in the past, so that we could focus the study on those locations to find archaeological pre-contact lithics scatter sites. And I used multi-azimuth hillshading, which is, you know, overlaying that shade but from multiple directions, and principal component analysis. I used sky view factor, which assumes how much of the sky is visible from a specific point in the landscape, and visualizes it that way. And then local relief model is a great way. It's often used in England to find like really, really small circular depressions in the ground. And so I used all these visualization techniques, and then I layered them. And I conducted a manual feature extraction process on 8 test areas and 2 blind study areas. So I had all this digital data of the existing heritage program. So all these areas had already been looked at by the Intilcotmuc Nation Tribal Council Archaeology Group. And they gave me all their data, and I used a blind study. So I didn't look at the data for a few areas, and I compared my manual feature extraction with their results. And I used 5 factors to just quantitatively analyze the difference between those 2 data sets.
How big were some of the areas that you were identifying as being potential sites?
Oh, well, so the whole mine site itself is about 30,000 hectares. So it's a huge area. And the actual small locations could be as small as 10 meters squared, you know, just little bumps on the ground, to like very large terraces that measure like hundreds and hundreds of meters squared. So it really varied. But, you know, the most common site size in this area for these small lithic scatter sites is probably around 200 meters squared.
Okay. So yeah, it's not too big. It's big enough, but I think when you're looking at such a large area, that's a very small thing to pick out of the whole area. So,
And again, these aren't anthropogenically created locations. I was just looking for natural areas on the landscape that meet criteria that we use in BC in this area to identify archaeological potential. And so I was just using slope percentage and elevation above surrounding terrain as my 2 factors. But, you know, in a real potential model, you would have a lot of other factors like distance from water features, presence of traditional trails. Right. There'd be a lot more layers to that. But that wasn't the type of study I did.
So essentially you're taking like an expert system where you've either questioned or from the literature got what do people with previous experience, what have they identified as being characteristics which were ideal for finding sites, and then you found a way to automatically identify similar features within your data, something like that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't automatic. It was I didn't write an algorithm for the pro a program or anything to automatically identify them. I just visually use the visualization
Okay, I
techniques
see.
to sort of amp up the contrast of the imagery, and then
Right,
that
okay.
made it easier to kind of pull out these areas of elevation. But you can you there are automated no no there well there are automated methods for doing LiDAR analysis. I don't have the GIS
Okay.
processing background to be able to do it, but it is something that people do. And, but in this specific environment, it wouldn't be very useful because there's so much disturbance to the ground from mining. So a lot of those areas aren't real landscape modification, you know. But in
Okay.
areas like Tonga, for example, I know there's been a study where they used an algorithm to have LiDAR data pull out all the burial mounds from like a huge area, and it was pretty effective. So it can be used for automatic analysis.
But so still, there's the benefit then of being able to do it from your desk without having to spend a lot of time in the field beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, the real benefit is that you can be in the office. You can kind of look at how much area of potential there is in a specific development component, and then you can even work with the developer to say like, oh, maybe we can adjust your development plan to impact less of those areas that I think have archaeological potential. So even before you even go out, you can minimize potential impacts to heritage, and then you can also save time on survey because then you just go straight out to those locations and have a look. It doesn't stop you from finding other areas of potential, but it kind of laser focuses you on those to say on those specific areas.
It's one more tool in the toolbox.
Exactly. Yeah.
What are some of the important things to consider when planning to use LiDAR in a project?
Well, I mean, specifically with LiDAR data, it's whether you have it already or not. And so if it's collected for a different type of study, it often isn't collected with archaeology in mind. So it isn't processed or filtered to find your target features. So that's something to consider. You may want to, ha if you have the geoprocessing ability, you may want to get that raw data from LiDAR and process it and filter it yourself, depending on what you're looking for. I know that people that use it for a cache pit location, this is a really important part of it. And then just understanding the types of imagery errors that can be present. LiDAR often plots with errors depending on how it's collected and how it's processed. So it can make it look like they call them imagery artifacts, which is deceptive for archaeology, but it'll make it look like there's a building there, for example, but there won't be anything there when you go there on the ground. So important to know that. It's important to know the resolution of the data you have. So I used two laser pulses per meter data, which is pretty good. With for publicly available data, it's often one pulse per 10 meters or one pulse per 20 meters. And then an optimal resolution for archaeology would really be 5 pulses per meter, but it's the more pulses, the more expensive it is to collect. And then just I would just say that analytically identifying those target features, so knowing what it is, the attributes of the target features you're looking for, is really important for LiDAR analysis. And then you can use like those visualization techniques that I talked about to optimize the contrast for the specific things you're looking for. And then just using like multiple, like we were talking about, it's just one tool in archaeological survey. So using that one tool and including a lot of other data like historic landscape alteration data, orthophotography, satellite imagery, there's a lot of different things available that you can layer and use together to look for archaeological sites.
And what were the results of your project?
So the results were pretty good. I mean, like any research project, they varied. A big part of my project was that I did not know how to use GIS at the beginning, which I think is a really good lesson for people. Like you can literally learn to do anything online during a pandemic. No, but just so the overall intersection of my information, my selected areas and the target features was only about 62%, but I captured between 75 and 92% of the recorded archaeological sites. So I only selected up to 62% of the total area that was identified in field as having potential. But then if you look at just the binary intersection, so whether my areas selected at least partially intersected with those found in the field, the results were more between 85 and 94% successful. So as a planning tool, it would be really effective, but it's just obviously not capturing exactly the alignment of a landform that people are seeing when they're on the ground, but it's in the neighborhood, and then I did analyze the accuracy and the weather. So in British Columbia, if you're using a predictive model, it has to capture 70% of archaeological sites between 10 and 20% of the land base. So like the more land you identify as having potential, the less refined your model is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So basically, was your model coming up with false positives? That's the criteria?
Yeah, well, that's the accuracy.
Yeah.
If you just circle the whole area and say it has potential, of course you're going to find all the archaeological sites, right? So it's not very refined. So my model meets the criteria for a moderately effective model. So it did a pretty good job.
Yeah, okay. What do you think that the company paid to do the LIDAR survey of such a large area?
So it's funny that you asked that question. My problem with academic research for techniques and new methods is that they often don't come with any budgetary information. And as a consulting archaeologist, to sell a method to a client, you kind of have to know what it's going to cost. You know what I mean?
Right.
So one of my research questions was to do a cost benefit analysis. It's something I do for work. And so I did do it for my MA research. And so, I mean, as a private person getting LIDAR, like say you wanted to have it for your study, I think it's like $500 per square kilometer, for example. And then you have to pay to have it processed and all that kind of stuff. Okay. So, but I didn't have to have it acquired for this project. So, and the mine did not share with me what it cost to have them do it. But there is a lot of open source LIDAR information as well. So it's always worth noting, like especially around municipalities, because they use it for planning a lot. So if you are doing urban archaeology or any kind of archaeology around the coastal areas, if you contact, there's a bunch of different websites you can go to. And if you contact the Canadian government, there's often open source LIDAR data available to use. But yeah, my cost benefit analysis was really rough. And it just found that if you were to completely replace, you know, hypothetically completely replace survey with in office LIDAR analysis and just take that piece out and then do everything else in the program the same way, you'd have an overall program savings of about 13%. And not to say that you should spend 13% less money on archaeology, but you could take that 13% and you could do things that are more, you could do more excavation. You could just do more high quality work at specific sites instead of having to spend all your time on survey. You know what I mean?
Right. So do you think that a lot of companies would be interested in pursuing this if they're going to do a project, for example, in oil and gas or in roads? Do you think that there's a lot of companies that would pay for the LIDAR data in advance of the fieldwork?
Yeah. I mean, it's not new, so a lot of companies do use it, and it's a pretty common thing. I know that in Northern Alberta, the forestry industry has just gotten high-resolution LIDAR for all the forestry area.
Oh,
okay. For planning. You know, they use it for planning. Mm-hmm. Where they're going to log, but they also give it to consultants so that they can use it to plan their programs to like find cost savings. And there's also a lot of research going into assessing its effectiveness up there. And then just things like specifically in BC, I know that they use it for any kind of reservoir work, like where it's you're working a lot of there's a lot of archaeological sites that are found when they do those drawdowns at reservoirs, you know, because everything's eroding out of the sides. And so I know that they use LIDAR to plan those types of surveys.
Okay, so in a lot of cases, the data might already be there.
Yeah, exactly.
And it would add very little in terms of cost to the project.
Yeah.
Well, that's definitely an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some other advantages of using LIDAR?
I read an article I was doing my research that said that safety was an advantage. And I hadn't really thought about that much. But if you think about it, it sometimes when you're trying to access places in really remote areas, it's really hard to plan your route. So using LIDAR to identify the most safe and effective manner to reach your survey location or
I didn't think of that.
Yeah, and they use it in places where like maybe you use LIDAR to look to see if there's specific archaeological concerns in really, really remote areas that would be really dangerous to get to potentially or extremely expensive. And then the developers can kind of plan where they're going to put things around that and just save things from for a safety perspective that way too.
What are some of the notable limitations of this method, though?
Oh, yeah. So I had a bunch of areas that I missed in one portion of the mine. And I was really interested why there was like 19 areas that I didn't pick up. And I went in the field to do a survey with the crew, the Endicott Nation Tribal Council members and crew. And there were a bunch of different locations that were had a traditional use component to them, which is why they were being tested. And I think in this case, there were large glacial erratics there, and there, or they were just out of the wind, you know, and so they would have been good for hunting camps. So that type of traditional knowledge, you're never going to get in the office looking at a map on your computer. So I think that it's sometimes people think of LIDAR as taking away the ability to go do survey in a meaningful way with Indigenous communities. And I think it's really important to make sure that it doesn't do that, and to make sure that people still get to share that traditional knowledge and spend time on the landscape looking for their cultural heritage. And then just a technical result was that my survey didn't pick up really low profile landforms. So anything lower, anything less elevated than about 50 centimeters above surrounding terrain wasn't picked up by my survey. Or areas where it was a damaged landform, I didn't pick it up. And then, so I missed those archaeological sites.
Do you think that traditional knowledge could be integrated with it, though? I mean, if you have your models of the landscape or the landforms, could you still be working in the office and get consultation from someone with traditional knowledge to help with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think it's really is the future of archaeology in BC, where I work, is all I know. But I know that a lot of nations, including the nation I was working with for my research, they do maintain traditional knowledge sites, place names, trail networks, like a huge amount of traditional knowledge about their landscape. And they often maintain it digitally. So you have that information that you can overlay if you're doing potential modeling. You can overlay it on LIDAR data to see, like, how do those trail networks, do they go between different archaeological sites? I think it's really, really useful for melding those two types of information together. And I know that a lot more First Nations communities in BC have their own archaeology and heritage management companies, and they often have a big component of that is a GIS department. So I think it is happening more and more.
How would you recommend that LIDAR be best implemented as a survey method?
I mean, LIDAR data, if you analyze it specifically for your target features and use it in the planning stage, I think can be a really effective tool to plan your survey, to identify sites, to identify areas where additional work has to happen. But I think it's also really important that you, if there are false positives, like you were talking about earlier, that it's really important to test those areas as well, to kind of increase that learning so that you know, you can keep feeding it back into your system. And, you know, machine learning that everyone keeps talking about with Facebook. But I just think it needs to be an iterative process. Like, you have to feed that real life information from ground truthing in the field back into your assessment methods to make sure that you're making the best choices that you can with digital data from the office.
Were there some cases where you identified potential locations that hadn't yet been discovered, or that hadn't previously been observed through the ground surveys?
Yeah, so I did identify. A rate of false positive identification for my data. And I did give that information to my research partners, so they have the ability to, over the next few field seasons, test those areas and see, or even just visit them and see what's there. The only ones I got to visit were those missed locations where I said were actually traditional use locations. I wasn't able to do any ground truthing of false positives for this project just because of COVID and just the way that really threw a wrench in all planning this year.
Right. Well, I was just wondering if there were any that might be false positives, but could actually be sites that were simply overlooked the first time that someone did field work. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe you discovered something that was not discovered by the field crews.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so they will be going to visit the false positive locations where they still exist on the landscape. Yeah. Over the next few field seasons. And again, I would have liked to do that for my study, but it wasn't possible. But I know that especially like LIDAR is often used to to find cache pits. That's like a big thing. There are no previously recorded cache pit features in this environment because it's high alpine, but it's used to find them. And so that's a really great way to go to all those locations where a cache pit wasn't found during field survey, but was maybe found in the LIDAR, and find out like what, if it is a cache pit, what about it made it be missed during survey, and kind of, you can again, like feed that information back into the survey planning.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell us what is a cache pit?
Oh yeah, sorry. I always forget that all over Canada, different archaeology. A cache pit is a circular depression in the ground. It has a rim usually, and is pretty uniform, and they're either the locations of where house pits were dug that have been infilled after they've been removed or collapsed, or they're locations where food caches were placed. And those are often in association with pit houses or villages or camping locations. You see them all over the interior of British Columbia. And often they'll just be huge pit. Sometimes they're huge pit house feature sites. Sometimes they're small single family camp areas.
What are your plans for the future regarding use and testing of LIDAR?
So I am graduating from my MA very soon, and I work again as a consulting archaeologist. So if I have the option to use it on projects going forward, I would love to. But I don't have any research specific plans going forward with it, but I am interested to see how my research partners continue to use it and test it in the area of my field study.
Are there any things that you would like to test in the future if you had the opportunity?
Oh my goodness. I just went to the CAA's and there was a presentation. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the researcher. He's out of UVic on Vancouver Island. And they're using LIDAR to assess the volume of midden material in shell midden sites on the coast. And I think that so interesting. And I'm really going to be following that data because we do work with quite a few midden sites. And I've done a lot of midden excavations, and also just using it to assess, you know, erosion of those sites in areas where, you know, because they're often right on the ocean. So I would really like to follow that research and possibly implement that into the work that I do in consulting.
Do you have some advice for young researchers, maybe undergrad students, for example, who are interested in doing research with LIDAR?
If I could provide some advice, it would be that I thought that I was not very technical focused. This was a prescribed research topic that I sort of went into because it was the one that was the most important to the community I was partnered with. And I think sometimes we tell ourselves about that we're not good at a thing or that it's not our thing. I have to say I was really, really, really enjoyed working with GIS software and with the LIDAR information. And I think that any GIS course you can do, there's tons of them online, and there's also tons offered through the universities, is super useful for a career in archaeology, academic or consulting. So that would be my recommendation.
This is very interesting work that you've done. I think that LIDAR has a lot of potential for doing large area research and for planning site prospecting surveys. Thanks for joining us today to tell us about your work.
Thanks very much for having me, Otis.
Have a nice day.
You too. Bye.
You've been listening to the ArchaeoCafe podcast. For more information and news, check out our website or social media pages. Links can be found in the episode notes or simply by searching online for ArchaeoCafe podcast. If you have any questions or comments for the presenters or guest speakers, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, I'll leave you with this quote from Stephen Dean. Archaeology gives a sense of place. It grounds us within the landscape, and every place is unique.